Sure.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode. And if you see who's joining me today, you may remember him from that reality show many moons ago. Real World San Francisco, Mr. Judd Winnick. How you doing, sir?
Good, sir. It is excellent to be here. And I almost wish people could have seen the first, 15 minutes we've been talking prior to this. That was a show unto itself. Us just chatting away, shooting the breeze. That's a good time. But thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I've been watching it for a while, and I know a lot of my real world and reality cohorts have been on here as well. So I look forward to it. Thank you.
Well, it's an honor to be speaking to you, and I appreciate those kind words. Obviously, we will get into, sort of your career and, what you've seen throughout the years as far as that journey throughout, quote unquote reality mm-hmm. TV. But just to kind of talk about today, what you do, can you kind of walk my audience through exactly, what you've had going on lately with, cause I know, you're a comic book, writer. What has kind of been the basis in recent years of what you've been up to?
Well, for those playing at home, when you met me almost 30 years ago on the Real World, I was an aspiring cartoonist, and now I'm an actual cartoonist. So that's always been the goal, and through a lot of luck and a lot of hard work, that's happened. So right now today, I do a graphic novel series. It's called Hilo. It's published by Random House. I'm literally finishing up my 11th book in the series. Thank the heavens and a lot of young readers, it does very, very well. So, and I'm thrilled with that. So, so it's an all ages graphic novel series for kids. It's an action adventure story. It's been about, we're coming up on 10 years. Wow. I've been doing it. Yeah, no. And again, it's I am thrilled because it took me a while to land right here doing this. I've done comic strips. I wrote superhero comics for over a decade. I did my own animated series. I wrote and produced animated series for other people. And I've written and drawn my own comic books. So this is actually, it's kind of like everything I've done kind of coming together in one place. So it looks like a comic strip. That's how I draw. I draw kind of goofy and it has lots of jokes in it like a comic strip. But it's all ages, like an animated series I would do. But it's a superhero story, just like all those. So the 10,000 hours I put in doing everything else kind of just landed here. And again, thankfully, it's doing very well, and kiddos like it. And kids' books are great. Kids' books are fun. Having an audience that is mostly children, it's a blast. They mm-hmm. are ridiculously honest in the best and sometimes in the worst ways, everything from I really didn't like the second book very much. But the third one was a lot better. That's cool. So do more like the third one. I will do that.
Mm-hmm. And that's always kind of what you've wanted to do then, right? So you've been able to kind of parlay your passion into now what would be your career.
Yeah. It's, I kind of feel a little bit like I came full circle.
Mm-hmm.
For when I was a kid and through my 20s, all I ever wanted to do was have a syndicated comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily I got to do that. And then after a little while, and we can get into it a little bit later, but because of the Real World, and actually I did a graphic novel about Pedro Zamora. It showed me that I want to be kind of a different storyteller. And that's when I started doing comic books. But again, the full circle part is comic strips are kind of an all ages affair. They are, they're meant to be read by everybody. They play a lot for jokes. They're drawn kind of goofy. And I'm doing that kind of now, except my other passion, which is superhero action, adventure, sci-fi and fantasy stuff. So I get to dig into every bag of tricks I can possibly imagine.
Did you have any either inspirations as far as either cartoons that you maybe, looked up to as a kid that maybe prompted you to want to get into this or made you passionate about this?
Oh, yeah. No, the very first comic strip I fell in love with is Garfield.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very old. So I actually was about 8 years old when Garfield started running. So I got to see it as it began, and I was a kid and I loved it. And then I graduated up to another comic strip called Bloom County by Burke Breffid. And then I spent a long time ripping off Bloom County. That was sort of my, that was my jam for a really long time, trying to do Bloom County, and succeeded in some ways here and there. I actually, you get good by emulating your, you know, your passions. So that is what I wanted to do. A little bit later came along Calvin and Hobbes. I was already well into being a teenager by then. I already wanted to do a comic strip, but comic strip wise, that was the things that really inspired me. It took me a really long time to figure out that I wanted to be more of a longer form storyteller. I thought I just wanted to do stuff that was in a newspaper, one joke a day, and that would have been great. And for a long time, that was like one of the greatest gigs in the whole world. You could, before newspapers took a huge dive with, basically with the flourishing of the internet. So in the 90s and the 2000s, newspapers used to be pretty much it. And everyone had a subscription, and newspapers would show up at their house every single day. And now that's really gone the way of the dodo. And with that, comic strips took a big hit. But that had nothing to do with my decision, really. It was more about that, kind of found my way towards storytelling. And I love it. I mean, seriously, I make things up and then I draw them. And, I live like a 10-year-old. when I was a kid, I used to draw pictures while I half watched television. Now I'm 53 and I draw pictures while I half watch television. That's my job. And it's the greatest. I love it.
Now, this is going to be an interesting question then, since you mentioned, thinking like a 10-year-old, like you're essentially, with what you do, you're gearing towards almost like trying to see through the minds in a sense of like children, because a lot of what you're doing is being, drawn and written for children. And then obviously you are a dad. So did you feel like in any way that those things have gone hand in hand for you? Like has, being like maybe a cartoon writer, has that helped you, with fatherhood at all? And has, fatherhood helped you with the other, with like kind of balancing and knowing like what's what between the two, do you feel?
Oh, I wish like being a big kid could have prepared me for being a father, but no, kids come out fully formed. They do. many things I could say here. To begin with, being a father is why I wound up doing this series in the first place. Hilo came about because my son, this is more than 10 years ago, when he was about 7 years old, he came to me and wanted to read some of my superhero comics I was writing. I was writing for DC Comics. He wanted to know if he could read some of my Batman comics. And I had to tell him, no, you may not read my Batman comics. Because he's seven and they're a little bit intense. Yeah. They're more for grown-ups and teenagers, especially like the run I was doing. It's a lot. So I gave him another series. It's by Jeff Smith. It's called Bone. And it's a phenomenal series. Which I read for years and years and years. And then they was republished by Scholastic in full color, and it was great. And he loved it. And I happen to be really good friends with Jeff Smith. He's a buddy of mine. So I told Jeff that my son just went bananas for Bone. And then Jeff sent us this gigantic box of Bone merchandise. Hats, t-shirts, calendars, action figures. And my son became a Bone super fan. Just everything in his world became Bone. And I got kind of jealous. I actually thought, I'm a cartoonist. I should be able to tell a story that he likes as much as Bone. And that is what started it. That is what I said, let me see if I can do one like this. And about a year and change later, about a year and a half later, I had my first draft of Hilo. So it was born out of love and jealousy.
That drives most people's success. Very
good. It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Whatever works.
That's how it started. That is how it started. So I wouldn't say that being a cartoonist or a big kid makes me a better father, but being a father made me a better cartoonist. Maybe, probably.
Well, you've obviously, been able, like I said, to kind of follow your passion and do what you love as a career. Yeah. When kind of speaking with other real worlders that come off these shows, sometimes their passions almost like either meet a wall initially when coming off the show, because like maybe people will look at it like sideways depending on like what world you're in. They might view it as like almost like a, you know, deterrence to what they've or trying to have going on. Did you feel like your time on the real world, did that like either help or impede your path at all, or where was that as far as you're concerned?
No, I mean, I've been, well, I'll start with this. So back in 1994, when we were just finishing up the show, I think we might have wrapped. Mm. We're like kind of gathering ourselves a little bit. George Vashore, who was one of our directors, and didn't particularly like me when we did the show. Mm-hmm. And I think George would be honest about that too. Like he didn't really. I was a bit of a know-it-all. I actually knew a lot about TV, and he felt like that I might have been conspiring a little bit to manipulate things here and there. And he wasn't exactly wrong. You know, and we would. I mean, anyone who talks about being on the show. I don't really know. What we did on our show is like we did a little bit of conspiring. Like, hey, they asked me about this during my interview, so that you might talk about that. Like, you know, it was a little bit us versus them. Not in a big, bad way, especially in hindsight, but just, you know. Anyway, George practically took me aside at one point when we were done, and he explained. He said, listen, something you should know, that when this is over, this show, this experience will open doors for you, but you still have to walk through them. So opportunities will present themselves, but you have to be prepared to seize the opportunities and do the work that's presented. It's not, you know, nothing's going to be handed to you, but suddenly you're going to find you have more access. And he actually said, like it happened for Eric Nice. It's like Eric was sort of on the trajectory. He said to do something like that. He was a model. He was an actor. He's a big personality. And so when he wound up doing all that, he said it probably happened a lot faster because the show, because those doors were open. You just had to be ready to walk through them. And I always remembered that. A lot, that nothing's going to be easy. I'm going to probably meet people and get to meet people and have meetings and have opportunities. And, you know, maybe I make a phone call and someone will actually call me back because of the show. But that right then, like, they're not going to say, great, do it. Like, no, now you got to show up. Now you got to do it. Luckily that happened. It happened more often than not. You know, I flamed out and crashed in lots of different things and failed in lots of different stuff, but it did happen. You know, I was able to reach out to people or met people and they remember me at the show and just like gave me a minute, you know. One of the most influential people in my life was a man named Bob Schreck, who wound up being my editor for a number of years. Bob, for anyone who knows comic books, Bob started off in a long career in comics, but was a big editor at Dark Horse Comics and was Frank Miller's editor for a really, really long time. And I literally met Bob at Comic-Con in 1995.
Oh, wow.
I just met him. He gave me the happy side eye. Like, I could sort of tell, like I gave him the up nod, like he recognized me. And we started talking. And he agreed to see my work. And he started to agree to publish my work through, he had started a comic book company of his own called Oni Press. They started publishing my work. And then when Bob left Oni and went to DC Comics and became a big shot editor over there, he called me again and said, do you like superhero comics? Like, yes, Bob, I love superhero comics. Like, you're the only person I know in the business hasn't called me for work. Why is that? It's like, I don't want to bother you. Like, shut up. Like, come on, let's talk. So Bob was my rabbi. And like, that's just like one of the biggest examples. The house that I'm in right now, I have because Bob took care of me for a number of years and believed in me. And so stuff like that. Again, I can tell you about another 10 stories where things didn't work out. Lots of things didn't work out. Those doors opened up and I had those meetings and did those things and it didn't happen. But for the most part, when I stayed my path of what I really want to do is make things up and draw them, it's usually worked out. In some way, shape, or form, and maybe not, you know, like I did a show for Cartoon Network and we were on for 4 seasons, like, you know, not a failure, not a big success that it ran for 10 seasons, but you know, everybody should get to do their own television show. These are failures. I do know So many of the folks who did the show, who've tried really hard to, you know, to parlay it into something else, and you hit major roadblocks because you've got that, you know, that sign around your neck that said I was on reality TV. And a lot of times, especially if you're a musician, making the jump from reality TV to being, you know, a musician, you know, very hard. People just really, really judge you. I mean, it's a little different now because you can make your own music and there's a lot of, you know, do-it-yourself stuff going on. But, you know.
Acting too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They viewed
people on reality TV as almost like, maybe this is too extreme of a word, but they viewed them almost like frauds in a sense. Like they were like imitators. Like they were very protective over their genre, like the entertainment genre as far as like acting goes, because they viewed reality personalities as sort of like imposters. Like,
oh yeah, interlopers, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially early on. I mean, maybe less now and again. It's hard because reality runs the gamut of, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of honest reality TV anymore. I mean, no. If there was such a thing, it's become a different thing. And that's okay. Just, you know, and how it evolves, you know, I mean, where it began is sort of like more, you know, documentary style. I mean, looking back, like the real world, which seems so lascivious and so ridiculous and over the top and scummy at the time, now looks back as a more tame version of reality TV that, like, oh, they just lived in a house and you filmed them. You know, it wasn't a game show. No one was competing. You know, it wasn't staged. They were just living together. I mean, we were staged as much as seven young people who didn't know each other were picked to live in a house they could not afford and maybe even not even get to know each other in real life in any significant way. But we put them together and let's go see what happened. You know, the fishbowl metaphor really worked.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's become so different. I mean, John Murray and Mary Alice Bunim, rest her soul, told us years ago, this is a long time ago, that they're having trouble getting an honest cast anymore, meaning that people who didn't have aspirations to be in entertainment, which is what they were looking for in the first place. You know, they didn't mind, like, as they said, like, we just really didn't want actors.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mind musicians or artists or, you know, like journalists, writers or whatnot. That was cool. But people wanted like act. Like we didn't want that. And then suddenly we're getting all these people were like, really? 6'1" guy who looks like a fashion model. You're just tending bar in Los Angeles. You got no aspirations for the entertainment business. You just want to, I just want to do the real world because I think it'll be a good hang. Yeah. And John Morales. They said eventually we just kind of gave up a little bit. It's like, we're not going to be able to figure or snuff out who's like in it to like make this a sort of like a platform to jump onto something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine in the sense of like, it evolves, it changes, mm-hmm. You know, it becomes something different.
So what was your impressions rather of like, you know, either the real world or MTV prior to actually being on it? Like, cause obviously there was two seasons before you that had aired. Did you have any preconceived opinion, before actually going on to it?
Oh yeah. No, I might be like clearly one of the last people to ask about this. Cause I looked at that. I thought it was great. I saw the first, I was 24 when I did the show. The first show started airing, first season in New York started airing when I was in college. I was the exact audience they were looking for. And I loved it. I thought it was incredibly interesting. And also felt like, you know, like I could be one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
That was the allure. That was the allure of the show, basically, that this was like people that you knew. And as it would turn out, yes, it was. And later I would be one of those people on the show. But, you know, they were just 20 somethings living in New York. I mean, I grew up in New York. So it was also, I felt that connection too. So I thought it was really interesting. And one of my best friends, Jessica Landau, who actually came to visit me when I was on The Real World and she made it on the air. Jessica and I were huge fans and we'd watch it together and talk about it a lot. And then when the second season came on in Los Angeles, which felt so decidedly different because they were just fighting so much more. But But I still dug it. I still dug the hell out of it and watched it. And again, it was interesting because it felt like people that you could know, but there they are on TV, suddenly famous and not famous for doing anything extraordinary except just be themselves or just living their lives. Doing, in a lot of cases, interesting things. Interesting things happened. And but at the time, it I think most of us watching really felt that it was well, we didn't see any subterfuge. It didn't seem phony at all, and a lot of it wasn't. Most of nothing was really back in the day. Nothing was staged. They didn't tell them what to do. Probably give or take a lie or two here or there, but you know, it felt real. It felt honest-ish. I mean, we understood. Yeah. Once you got past that, well, they couldn't afford to live in the house like that. Like, of course not. You know, that's the premise. Like, that's the whole idea. Like, we're taking away, like, here you go.
You're putting people in, like, unfamiliar environments and, you know, like, unfamiliar environment. Yeah. Forcing them to kind of meet people from, you know, different walks of life. You know, that's the whole point, because if you put somebody in an environment they're not used to, you're going to, you're basically almost in a sense doing, like, it's almost like one, it's obviously a documentary, but it's almost like an experiment. So
yeah,
that's the whole point.
No, it's very different people who would not have met under a lot of circumstances, much less lived together. And they bumped into each other. I mean, initially, you know, the first many, many seasons, you know, people of different races, backgrounds, economic situations, aspirations, and they would say, the wrong things to each other. And sometimes they would have, you know, heated conversations. Sometimes they would have more measured conversations. Sometimes both. Sometimes they'd blow up at each other and then later come back and, well, let's talk about it. And that is the unreality of it, is that because you're living together, that, like, you know, we actually have to hash this out because we can't just let this lie. Right. You know, just, it can't just. And that was interesting. That was interesting to me as a young person to watch them, like, go through that stuff, you know. You know, like the first seasons, watch like Kevin Powell go at it with Becky or Julie. And, it's just, I was just talking to Pam about this the other day, that with, when it comes to Kevin, what's wild about, Kevin Powell, who got tagged as like the angry black man. If you go back and watch, so much of what Kevin had said back in 1992 has come to fruition in such a shockingly and uncomfortable way. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing. And again, that was discussed in, like, he was discussing issues of race in 1992. And it made it great. It made it great. And it's still great in that way. And reality TV can be great in that way. Still, we're not doing it as much, but you know, but it's, again, I'm sounding overly critical. And I don't mean to be, no, because I mean,
it's fine to have, you know, opinions in a constructive way. I think, you know, what you're saying is pretty much spot on from what, from my account. I mean, it's, the times have obviously changed. We live in a, you know, world where social media and agendas and, like, you know, there's always like something ahead rather than present when it comes to people that go on these shows now that kind of already have like a formula of like either how they're going to go about what they say and do, where they see themselves after the, so, you know, when your generation was there, you guys weren't worried about what was to come or what might end up coming of it. You were worried about just like, oh, here I am in like this like city that I've never been before with people that I've never seen before. And like, you know, let's just see how it goes, I guess.
Oh, I mean, you know, like, yes, no one back in 94 was thinking that, like, well, I got to watch that because that's a little bit off brand, you know, because I want to, you know, just, I have this portrayal that I want to put out there and whatnot. I mean, it is in a way, because, I mean, the general conceit is that nobody wanted to look stupid. Nobody wanted to look like a bad person. No one wanted to be misrepresented. So in that way, you spend an awful lot of time maybe talking about your point of view and making yourself clear if you're smart about it.
Right.
You know, if you, I mean, in that way, it's like, you know, like I was acting like an asshole with this person. Let me go talk to them. And maybe if you're, maybe the unreality of it is that you're forced to have this conversation with somebody because you know it's going to be on TV mm-hmm. and you don't want to come off like an asshole. But in that, it does force you to confront, like, you know, whatever the issue might be in like a real way, and be like, it forces you to try to be a decent person. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing a lot of that today because it's okay because it's entertainment and people are having fun, and you know, and I don't feel like I'm like doing this backdoor criticism of the challenges or whatnot, because you know, it's a blast. It's a blast how it came about. Like, real world begat road rules, which begat the challenges, which then turned into so many people like turned it into their own cottage industry and gave birth to a lot of like reality celebrity hosting and whatnot that we see now. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, bygones, I did, you know, 15 or 20 auditions where I talked to people about hosting. You know, I met with Aaron Spelling about doing a talk show. You know, all these things went nowhere, but, I did that too. Just people ask, you know, because as George said, these doors will open. You just have to be able to walk through them. And the truth was, it turns out I couldn't walk through them and do a talk show. But I could walk through them and do spot illustration for the Complete Idiots Guide series and did that for 4 years and paid the bills, you know, things like that. You know.
Yeah. So did you go to like an open casting call then when, you know, initially getting onto the show, or were you sought out?
No. Well, I was not sought out. Did not go to an open casting call. I guess I was like, it's summer of like 93, and I'm watching Real World 2 in Los Angeles. I just lost a job to develop my comic strip. I had a development deal with Universal Press Syndicate, who syndicates comic strips. They were doing to develop my comic strip. It was supposed to last a year before they syndicated me. Then they dropped me from my contract because they didn't feel I was good enough. And I had to move back in with my mom and dad. And then I'm watching Real World 2. I'm watching John and Beth and Dominic and the gang fight and do whatever they're doing. And an ad comes up. Said, do you want to be on Real World 3 San Francisco? Send us a letter and a photo telling us why. So I sent them a letter and a photo telling them why. I even crafted my letter to make it seem like it was a little bit off the cuff. Like wrote a couple of drafts. This is where the subterfuge and bullshit comes in. Like I put it on this stationery. It was a very cartoony stationery I had where all the borders had like all these like cute drawings and shit. And again, I made it seem like I just wrote it off the cuff and crossed a couple things out, even though I rewrote it a couple times. Send in like my most handsome photo. And I used to be good looking, you know, I used to be pretty back in the day. So it started with that. So I sent it a letter and a photo and I made the next round. The whole thing took 6 months and there were six rounds of casting. They never called it casting. They never called it auditioning. It was just the process. I made the next round. So then I filled out a 15-page application and made my own video. You can make it as creative as you like. Made the next round and they interviewed me on the phone while a friend videotaped me. Made the next round where they followed me around with a camera for a day. Like someone followed me around for a day. Then I think either before or after that, they interviewed me in person in New York. John Murray, Marius Bunim, George Vashore, Lisa Berger, who was one of the producers, they interviewed me at the MTV studios in New York. And then the last round is they flew us out to Los Angeles for final interviews where they flew like 15 of us. We found out later and sort of deciding who it was. Now, at the time for me, I had no next move. I did not know what I was going to do with my life. I had just lost this development deal. I had moved back in with my parents. I was 23 years old. And I didn't know what I was going to do next. I was ready to try to do the next thing, but I kept making the next round of the Real World and kicking the can down the road. So this is from like the summer of 93 till January of 1994. My life was in limbo. It was sort of like, so what are you up to, man? It's like, well, I'm thinking of heading out to LA, maybe getting like an internship or a job like an animation company or something, but I might go in the Real World. Like what? It's like, yeah, I don't know. They keep saying yes. So I'm waiting. So it was a very weird time and particularly stressful, like, because at one point it's like, God, I wish I didn't want it so much, because I'm putting my life on hold. I don't know what's going to happen. And it worked out. You know, I got on the show. It's like, okay, so I'm going to go do this now. Okay. So that's how it happened.
Oh, man, I can't even imagine what that camera quality might have looked like back then.
Oh, the one dude following us around? Yeah, it's us. So, yeah, no. There was a it was a handheld. And, well, in general, if you, like, you look back, like, you know, video was still kind of in its infancy. Right. And even our season was shot kind of rough. They had not worked out the kinks yet about how to film reality TV. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think by the fourth or fifth season, they said, forget, like, we're going to make it more like they're living on a set as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a house, but we're going to, I mean, our place, they didn't quite gut it. They, you know, they put in lighting and the ceiling and stuff like that, but a lot of it was still very ad hoc. And seriously, the dude following me around for a day was just that, like, mm-hmm. you know, this dude with a backwards baseball cap, whose name I forget, but was around my age, who just like, so what are we doing? And like, well, I'm going to wake up on Long Island. We're going to take the LIRR into the city. And I'm going to go hang out and visit some friends. And then come back here and have dinner with my parents. Is this cool? Like, I told production, well, I was going to do this. I go, yeah, no, just you be you, do your thing. And it's like, okay. You know, and that was it.
That must have been really pretty convenient too, because I mean, you were living in New York at the time, and then like the MTV studios were in New York, so it all kind of just feels like it all worked out, like the way
it felt right. It felt right, and it felt like, you know, like you know, the synergy of the whole thing. I felt like, you know, I didn't know how close I came to not getting on the show several mm-hmm. times. Like, it was this far away from, like, you know, for me, it was sort of like, because as far as I knew, you know, I do the thing, and like 3 weeks later, it's like, congrats, made the next round. I'm like, oh my God, great. Like, what now? It's like, okay, so we're going to come visit us in the at MTV Studios at 1515 Broadway. We're going to be like, so all that was cool. I mean, you know, I thought I had exciting things to do, but at the same time, didn't know how badly things had gone here and there, just how much I just sort of skated by here and there. And I shudder to think if I hadn't made the show, what my life would have been. I mean, I can't even, you know. Yeah.
That's such a butterfly effect to even try and think about. What do you think it was, you know, about you that might have, you know, drawn them to want to pick you? Like, could you pinpoint anything to where you're like kind of have an inkling of an idea where you're like, oh yeah, I think maybe they enjoyed this about me.
I was a smarter.
Smarter. Mm-hmm.
I think actually I wasn't when we did the show. I don't think I was the smartest as much as they wanted me to be. I mean, mm-hmm. One of the things that happened, which I found out later from a woman named Carol Woodruff, who was John and Mary Ellis's assistant, mm-hmm. and who we became friends afterwards, and just was a fan. Like, she liked me and thought I'd be good on the show. So Carol was pushing for me. And Carol would see everything, and although she was like just an assistant, she did a lot. They followed me. So one dude followed me around with a camera for the day. And what I'd find out later, and I wasn't aware of, like, as I was doing it, my parents, my friends, everyone I was hanging out with were just camera hogs. They didn't shut up. Everybody I knew was playing for the camera, was chatting up, wouldn't be quiet, all this energy. And I just sat and listened for like the whole day. I was extremely quiet, low energy, not a lot of personality the whole day. And as Kara told me later, like, so I watched a bunch of it. John Murray had watched a bunch of it. It's like, oh, okay, so that didn't work out. But Kara, who like thought I had something, watched like all of it like until the end. And so at the end of the day, literally, the day is over, and I call one of my best friends and then proceed to shit talk everybody for the whole day. Like, and actually talk about like It's like everybody was being ridiculous, is what I'm telling my buddy on the phone. Like, what do you mean? Like, oh my God, like my dad is like Spielberg over here. He's like trying to set shots. Like he's going and sit on the floor next to the couch. And so he can angle it properly and be like on camera while he's talking. I said, this one, like, he's telling me this funny act. Like, and I went through everybody and just shit talked them. And Kara said, it was so funny. I said, John, come here. Come. Like, she called John Murray back. Like, watch this. I was like, oh, that's pretty funny. And so later I found out, like, he's a good narrator. He's a good narrator. So even if, like, I'm not doing business so much, like even if, like, they felt like, even if he's not, like, could be a big personality with the other castmates, he's someone who can really talk on camera and maybe help us out with, like, narrating through the series. And it turns out I did a lot of that. Like, I spent, you know, I might not have been doing a lot of shit, but I was always the smart alecky guy who was talking about things going on in the house. So I think being a Weisenheimer, as they used to say, was helpful.
Well, they're very careful with kind of how they typecast. Like, you've obviously got, like, you know, your people that are going to get into a lot of drama, like, within the, you know, house and within the group. But you also do have, like, your room readers, such as yourself, that are able to kind of, you know, provide commentary and kind of explain what's going on. Like, listen, it's one thing to be able to be entertaining, like, within the group. But there's, you know, there's another key component that is very important, I feel, to reality, to make a good reality TV show, is it's you got to have somebody that's able to provide, like, either witty or just, like, precise commentary of what's going on. So I've actually always gravitated towards those that are able to kind of either be compelling or be interesting when talking about what's going on within the, you know, the, I think they call them the confessional rooms these days. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, when they're doing the as we're doing right now, they talk right to camera folk. Pam and I always, I mean, we're, you know, we lived inside the Matrix, so we can see what the ones and zeros are when we're watching reality TV. And we're often will be watching reality TV. Like a perfect example, we'll watch the British Baking Show, and we sort of made a game of, like, and British Baking Show is, like, the sweetest, most wonderful reality TV show that's still out there. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you win? You win a plate. There's no money. It's like bragging rights, and that's it, and it's great. But we'll often watch the people and go, like, oh no, they're good on camera. Like, mm-hmm. oh no, she's really good on camera. And it just means, like, you know, when talking, you know, not just like the baking and the crap, but when talking directly to camera, when interacting with people as they're baking, like, oh, they got something there. And we came to British Baking late, and then we'd look it up, like, oh no, she's got 2 TV shows and 4 books. Okay, so they realized too that this woman we were watching the British Baking Show has some game. So we get it too. Like, it's, there is something to there. There's the bomb throwers, you know, the folks that come in there are like, mix shit up, who don't necessarily can turn it around and, like, do anything after their particular program. Like, they're, as you said, like, they're in there and they make the drama. Making drama doesn't mean you can ever, like, get out of the bubble of the reality TV show you did, but someone who can really talk about the drama and navigate their way through about it might be someone who, you know, winds up, you know, hosting a thing or doing another thing or whatever, you know, it can work that way.
Where are you now with kind of, I mean, we talked a little bit, you know, before the recording about how you are, but, where are you as far as, like, or just, you know, in recent years even too, when it comes to, like acknowledging, you know, your time on the show? Because I know, like, obviously San Francisco is, like, a season that's referred to a lot, like, when people think back to shows. It was a very, like, influential show, you know, for sometimes better, for sometimes worse. But it feels like with most of your cast, it almost feels like the digital footprint, like, as far as, like, within reality TV itself, doesn't really exist as much as it did, like, back when the show existed. Like, at least, you know, you've got LA and New York, even they've got people that have gone on to do, like, challenges after the fact, and even still in recent years have done, you know, reunions with their cast for the real world itself. Whereas it feels like San Francisco is a show where, you know, the digital footprint, people kind of have almost either gone their separate ways, you know, or just don't really look to involve themselves with the show altogether in some cases. Where have you been as far as that goes?
Well, To break it down, and I'm assuming if they're watching this, they know quite a bit. We had, you know, I think we had the most extraordinary experience. It was supposed to be in deference. We were supposed to be doing a dumb TV show. Mm-hmm. You know, it was going to be cool. It was going to be fun. You know, we're going to do what we could not to look stupid. And it was going to be a goof. Everybody was doing it. It was going to be a goof. You know, it's going to be fun. You know, cutting to the end of the page, I met Pam Ling, who is a cast member on the show and a complete stranger when I met her. And we start dating after the show. And we've been together for almost 30 years. And we have a house and two children and my whole life. You know, we have our whole lives because we did this dumb TV show. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, going back and doing more reality TV or doing an adjunct to it or getting involved in what it's, you know, we kind of live with it every day. We're here. It's part of our lives in such a way, but also, it was something that was special to us. We had directions again, whatever. I wanted to be a cartoonist and Pam wanted to be a doctor, and none of that changed after the show. I became a cartoonist and she became a doctor. And with that, it didn't. Every year that they would do one of the challenges, they would call us and want to know if we wanted to participate. And every year the answer was no. And it was, we had work, you know, just, yeah. You know, we just didn't have like 2 months to go on TV and like, you know, and also, you know, and do crazy shit. You know, it's like, I don't want to put on a Speedo and sit on a block of ice to see who can do it the longest for money. And again, not knocking it, but it just wasn't going to be my thing or Pam's mm-hmm. thing. You know, and it became part of our lives in that way. Now, stepping back further, we met Pedro Zamora, who became our very good friend, who in so many ways literally changed the world. You know, he was someone who was living with AIDS. You know, he was gay and he was out. And in 1994, it was a time before AIDS was treatable in any real significant way. And he died 3 months after we finished. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't supposed to happen either. When we did the when we met him and we did the show, many of us, Pam and I in particular, and Corey, and Muhammad, you know, realized that something extraordinary is happening here. Like Pedro came there with a mission, with a job to do. He wanted people to see what it was like to be living his life, to understand what it was like to be living with AIDS in a real way. Because back then, no one had seen that before. Mm-hmm. When you saw someone who was living with AIDS, they were usually dying, and you saw them on the news, and they looked like. There were these young men who looked like they stepped out of Auschwitz and they're covered in, you know, KS lesions and they looked like they were dying because they were. But Pedro was funny and handsome and vibrant and beautiful and changed the way people thought and gave people, either educated people who didn't understand or gave people the bravery to come out themselves or take the risk themselves or protect themselves. It became so much bigger. And his life was an international story. We became a part of that. So with that, to come back and do something like a reunion, we can never do a reunion. Pedro's gone. It's never going to happen. We're never going to get back there. And also, you know, and don't think I'm ignoring him on purpose, but Puck was a huge part of the show. Puck right. was the star of the show. It was Puck and Pedro was what it was about. Puck became, you know, basically the boilerplate of what reality TV would be in a lot of ways. You know, when our season was on, the two biggest shows on MTV were Beavis and Butthead and The Real World. And, you know, Buck was like almost a living embodiment to Beavis and Butthead in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he kind of became the villain, the shit stirrer, the bomb thrower. And that would become sort of like an MO for a lot of reality TV. Mm-hmm. But as we got into it and later, you know, it became less important, less of a big deal just to sort of like continue the fight with Puck after the fact. Cause you know, Pedro died, you know, he got sick and he died badly. It wasn't pretty. It was horrible. And to have these debates later, I mean, it was you know, funny in quotes, you know, when young people would want to come and like, you know, debate about us, like asking Puck to leave the house, you know, like, and a lot, you know, a lot of times I would just shrug. It's like, listen, man, I don't care. Like, I don't care if this means anything to you. It's okay. I mean, I understand you watched a television show and you thought we should let him stay, but it's okay. You know, our friend who lived in the house died. Right. And, you know, and by the way, Puck got everything he wanted. It worked out for him. He became a VJ. He had offers. Things happened just the way it was supposed to. And it didn't pan out for him because, as we talked about, sometimes being the bomb thrower in a reality show doesn't necessarily equip you to navigate your way in the world as a host, as a personality. You know, you've got to be able to show up on time, be a grown up and do the work and listen to people. And sometimes the folks who bring the drama to the show are not those people who are equipped with that for any number of reasons. Reasons that aren't even their fault. Mm-hmm. You know, they're people who bring drama because they have drama or they have problems, you know, and maybe they shouldn't be on reality TV in the first place. So as far as all of us, like, kind of going our separate ways, we keep in touch. We know each other and we're still here. We just haven't done the thing. No one even asked us to do a reunion.
No calls or anything like that.
No, I heard not a rumor, but I caught wind from a friend of a friend who said, like, yeah, they're thinking of doing San Francisco. Like, how? You know, there's a lot, like, they can't. I mean, you know.
There's a lot of juggling parts there to begin with. One, you know, we don't no longer have Pedro with us anymore. And then, like, not many people know of where, you know, Puck's even whereabouts are to begin with.
I don't know if he could quite do that, and if he wanted to, how that would work. And I mean, the old idea is, like, so you guys would live together for 3 weeks. Like, that's not gonna happen. I mean, for me and Pam, like, we have kids, you know. So yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, can your kids stay with somebody, like, for 3 weeks while we go do this? Like, no. I mean, you know, it's like, it can't be the reunion the way y'all are setting it up. We're like, you know, we're old. We can't leave our lives like this and do this in this way. You know, I don't think Corey would have any interest in doing it. I'm not sure Muhammad would. Not in the way they set it up. I mean, if you want to all gather us up in some way and for us to do this, where we talk.
A virtual thing, maybe.
Well, you know, just, you know, we come someplace and try to have a decent meal together without killing each other. Mm-hmm. And then, like, talk separately or together, like, on camera or whatnot. Like, that could be it. But that's not what they want. They want a bit of a car wreck because they're making television. And so it's okay. Again, it's okay. You know, New York came together, had the reunion, and there was a car wreck, you know, and LA got together, a couple of car wrecks in there. Oh, New Orleans
was a catastrophe.
Holy shit. Oh my goodness. I mean, that was, you know, my heart went out to everybody. And, you know, and you know, we were like the last people to watch the show too, as far as like watch these reunions. They're hard to watch.
Right.
I'm not even sure we watched all of it. I'm trying to remember if we watched the entire seasons because, it hits far too close to home.
Hard.
Literally.
Like hard from the aspect of like having lived it yourself and knowing those people, it like almost like strikes a different nerve than it would for somebody who like doesn't have that experience to relate to, rather than like the quality itself.
Yes to all of that.
Yeah.
So in some cases we know the people, some of them we know a little bit, some we've met a few times. So there's that. Secondly, we know it's being edited and we can see when things are happening and when things are like untrue. Because again, I mean, I made the reference to it just for clarity. You know that scene in The Matrix where Joe Pantoliano is talking about these looking in the Matrix, and he like everyone else looks at it and they see ones and zeros going down. He said, like, I can see blonde, redhead, and whatnot. Like when we watch reality TV, we can see where the cuts are. We can see where things are being put together a little bit more than probably other people because we live through it. And as we would watch, and after doing The Real World, Pam and I would watch The Real World. And we'd watch people screw up and just head in hands, like, don't say that about your dad. Oh God, that's Thanksgiving the rest of your life. Your father's looking down the table at you, remembering when you shit talked him on The Real World. Like, yeah, yeah. It's like for you, like it's a minute of your life, maybe, and like it's gonna be the rest of your life because you talked garbage about that person. Like, don't do that. So similarly, watching the reunions. And watching like older people make the same sort of mistakes or being put in the situation where these mistakes are happening or being put in the situations where that's not exactly what happened. We can sort of see what's happening there. That's, you know, they're going to stay pretty close to the truth. It gives us, we're not watching it. We're kind of experiencing it. It's just hard. It's just hard. Hearts go out. We just, it's so much empathy. It's like, it's hard to watch.
Yeah. They actually took them down. They're no longer like, they're not available to watch anymore. They took them down, I believe, back in, I want to say like the end of, oh yeah, it was like the end of 2022 or no, beginning of this year, actually. Yeah. The very beginning of this year, they completely wiped the slate clean. They're not on Paramount Plus anymore.
The reunions are gone, or the Real Worlds, or any of them?
Like the homecomings, yeah. Those three. The
homecomings are gone.
New York, the LA, and the New Orleans one.
That is
a year. They're gone.
I have so many questions. I mean, I do know, like, inside baseball, that Paramount Plus has had, like, this huge upheaval and fired everybody and hired these people. And, like, you know, a lot of, like, boring economic TV crap. I mean, there's, you know, and when I say inside baseball, look it up. Paramount Plus fired a whole bunch of people, and, you know, so that might have to do with something. And when the shows are no longer on there, you don't have to pay out royalties. Not that the people doing the shows are getting any royalties, because they're not. Yeah. But the people make the shows, so there might be something on there. But I mean, I'm asking because I haven't checked like in a little while. Are the Real World still running on Paramount Plus?
The original seasons are on there. Okay, but they just like those new ones where they
reunite. Yeah, no, the homecomings are gone. I'm more curious about the homecomings. I almost feel like I think it's probably good for the people who did the shows that they're not on there quite so much. But I like that the old shows are on there. I particularly like that our season is running a Paramount Plus. Because frankly, there's people watching the show now who weren't even born when we did it, who get to experience the life of Pedro Zamora all over again. I mean, we still hear about it. It's never stopped. It has never stopped when young people and older people, but it's always very interesting when some 17-year-old comes up to us to say that they watched our season, how much it meant to them to see Pedro. You know, it's just, well, you know,
like the barometer for, you know, most other gay men that would then go on to do the show themselves.
Yeah.
Like he served as sort of like the benchmark for like inspiring, you know, other gay men to either one, just like come out in their real lives, or if they were themselves going on the show, he was, you know, in most cases the reason. Like, I've interviewed countless amount of people that have, you know, you guys were season, you know, 3. I had somebody from like season 24 tell me that they watched him in real time, and that's why they auditioned. Like, so
it's amazing. I mean, we still literally still hear from people all the time who came out to their friends, came out to their family, got tested, you know, became AIDS educators, moved to San Francisco, completely changed their lives because they watched him on this television show. But it was one of those things. I mean, it's to circle back. It's why I think it's kind of important to us that, I don't know, that isn't sullied in some sort of way, because it means a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And us too. I mean, it's like, you know, it's our lives, you know, it is absolutely and constantly there. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here with you, and up on my wall here is a picture of Pedro, a picture of my son, a picture with me and my best friend, you know, and pictures of me and Pam and our daughter and our son as well. Like, this is our every day, you know, and when our children were growing up, people would come up to us all the time recognizing us, and we would talk to them and whatnot, and our kids would say, are those people friends of yours? And it's like, no. It's like, well, why did they hug you goodbye? And it's like because remember we talked about the television show we did, and you remember we talked about Pedro, and so and Pedro's always been a part of their lives. And then the older they got, you know, I mean, after a while it became a little bit fun. They would be like with teachers, or they would be, I don't know, like a day camp or some event or a little thing, and just organically say something like, yeah, my mom and dad met on TV. And any adult would go, what? And a lot of times they go, like, what do you mean your parents met on TV? Like, they were on this television show, The Real World. Like, what? It's like, who are your parents? Like, my parents are, their names are Pam and Judd. Like, your parents are Pam and Judd? And like, when they were like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, like, so like, oh, let me see how this goes. Let me sort of sneak this into conversation that my parents are Pam and Judd from The Real World and see what happens. And they started doing that a lot. And now and again, like, tell the wait staff at restaurants, like, be cool. guys, like, don't do that. Like, they might give us free dessert. Like, look, that happened a couple of times, but you don't, you got to be cool. You got to let people bring it. You don't tell them. And so, like, again, it becomes our lives. This is like who we are. You know, we're a little bit famous for being a little bit famous, you know, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't go on from that.
I think it's kind of amazing that not only were, cause you know, we've seen in other cases too, like people have met on television and like, you know, they've ended up getting married and it's lasted forever. It's kind of amazing what you and Pam have won, you know, been able to, you know, meet from TV and get married, build the life that you have. But like, at what point did you kind of, did you know, like, did you always know immediately, like, that this, like, it felt real, like, or like, did you ever in the beginning, like, wonder to yourself, like, I wonder what it's going to be like now that we're off the show? Like, how much did you question yourself?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, for one, it was not love at first sight. And I mean that in the sense of, like, when I first saw Pam, it's like, wow, she's beautiful. But the first day I met her was the first day we're filming the show. And Pam and I have the exact same story. We're filming the show for the first time, which means we are walking around this house and people are following us around with cameras for the first time. Two cameras, one here, a guy with a boom mic, this and the other. And our only instructions are don't look at the cameras. And we're pretending this isn't happening. And this takes days to get even a little bit used to it because it's weird. It's weirder than you could possibly imagine. So the idea that, like, I'm gronking anything except that, like, here's this person, that person. Like, all you're doing is trying not to look stupid and, like, and try and just get through this in some way and be and get comfortable or whatever. But later, we had this amazing experience of being a part of Pedro's life, you know, and we started dating after the show, and we started dating after Pedro got sick. You know, we started dating at this really terrible time, you know, when Pedro got sick, and we had these discussions wondering, like, what is this? You know, is this about that we're comforting each other because we're going through this terrible and bizarre experience? You know, the show is still running. You know, it's just airing for the first time. You know, Pedro got sick in August. The show started in June. And it's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be great. And then he's getting sick. And then we got a diagnosis and we realized that he's going to die in a couple of months. And so we were very much aware. I mean, the show in itself as its construction was very helpful in this way that we've often described the real world as it's like therapy without the help. Every week you got to sit down for 2 hours and talk about everything that happened, except no one gives you any kind of like rhythm or help to examine what's going on, but you have to stay present. So we were very big about trying to stay present all the time about what was going on. So Pam and I would talk about it. Like, is this something that we're experiencing because we're sad because our friend is sick and this is like one of the worst things that ever happened to us and we're here for each other, or is it something more? And the truth was, we just like, I don't know, but we'll just have to see. And after Pedro passed away, and Pam is like, she's in her residency at medical school, and I'm living in LA. And then I started touring and doing lecturing about Pedro. But we would talk all the time, and we'd check in all the time, and we missed each other all the time. And then we'd see each other all the time as much as we could. And, you know, and then it was like, let's move in together. You know, we've already done that, except now we're doing it without cameras.
Yeah.
And it felt the most natural thing in the world. It actually felt less stressful because we just get to be in the same place together, and we don't without other people, without cameras and shit. So, you know, and I mean, in hindsight, it all worked out because we just, you know, we were in love, we were together, and we became a couple. But we did question it initially, but more about, is this just because we're in pain and everything's just terrible and we're the only people who understand what's going on so we can be there for each other? That was part of it, but it wound up only just being part of it because it turns out that as a couple and moving forward, we went through this amazing and terrible and exciting and horrible thing together, you know, equally as part of it. And we had the same shared experience. For that reason, you know, we have this shorthand that no one else has, you know, it's just part of us.
Like nobody has like what you two have like together. So
we have nothing to compare it to, but probably, yeah.
Yeah. I also too got to ask too, because, you know, you're obviously, you know, a cartoon writer. One of your, I believe it was one of your books was called The Lost Days. And
yeah,
it had to do a lot with like loss and acceptance. Did a lot of like that writing, like for you come as inspiration from, you know, with Pedro?
Yeah. I mean, to circle back, I mean, the storyteller I am, and what I do is like, you know, I write, I make things up and I draw them. I do long form graphic novels and comic books. Mm-hmm. It was completely born out of my friendship, my relationship with Pedro. Mm-hmm. We lost Pedro, when Pedro got sick, before he got sick, he was going to go on a lecture tour. He was going to go all around the country and talk to colleges. Supposed to speak to a whole bunch of colleges. He got sick. He felt bad that he had to cancel. And he wanted to know if I could maybe sub in for him. And he even said, most of them are going to cancel because you are not me. But I want to offer you as a substitution because I feel bad. Is that okay? And it's like, I don't know what I'm doing. That's what I told him. It's like, it's okay. We're going to work on it. And it's like, just tell them what it's like to know someone like me. Tell them like who you are. Tell like, they're going to have more in common with you than me. Tell them your story. But tell them about me and tell them about safer sex practices. And like, and we went through it. And then off I went and I started lecturing. And I did that for a couple of years. And at one point, it just got steadily harder and harder to do. To get up in front of people and talk about what it was like to lose him over and over again. So I stopped. But in that mix, I started doing a comic strip. And it was called Frumpy the Clown. It's about mom, dad, two kids, and this obnoxious clown they live with. And I felt this urge to somehow still tell Pedro's story in some way. I thought about introducing a character into the comic strip that was kind of like Pedro. And as I started planning it, I thought, like, this is dumb. This is weird. It doesn't feel right. So I started doing a book. And I'd never done a book like that. I'd never done a graphic novel or anything like that or a comic book. And I wound up doing this 250-page comic book about Pedro. And when I was done with the book, I said, you know what? This is how I tell stories. And I stopped doing the comic strip. I started doing comics and graphic novels. And I still do that today. And I owe that all to Pedro. So I say all that to say this is that so much of my work is informed by knowing him. There's a lot of my stories, there's always loss.
Mm-hmm.
Every time. I mean, you know, every time from the superhero comics to... I did this really goofy series called The Adventures of Barry Ween, Boy Genius, which was a 10-year-old boy with a 300 IQ who blows shit up and says fuck every third word. But it got to a very sort of serious place, this place of like loss and hurt. And a lot of that had to do with like sort of reflecting upon Pedro's story. And even my kid's story, Hilo, we lose one of our characters. And in that book, actually, I dedicate that book to Pedro because that's what it's about. It's about loss. And also, yeah, my Green Arrow run, my Batman run, there's a lot of stuff in there, storylines in there, because of this experience and my other experiences. I mean, it's like, it's not everything.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, it's not my entire life is not this experience. And I don't want to diminish Pedro's memory at all by saying like, you know, it's informed everything I do, but a lot of it is. And I think part of it was us being so young when we, you know, young, you know, ish, you know, we were in our, I mean, I don't think I was a full-fledged adult. It took going on a reality program for me to become a grown-up. You know, I thought like in my early 20s, I had my big boy pants on, but it wasn't until doing what was supposed to be, again, this dumb show that wound up being everything for me. And, you know, I met the person I spend the rest of my life with. I met a person who informed so much of what I am and what I do because I knew him, you know, and to think if Kara hadn't like watched to the end of my tape and said, John, you should come look at this. He's funny when he's shit talking his friends. We can use a shit talker on our show. That, you know, you and I wouldn't be talking, and I don't know what I'd be doing right now.
Yeah, imagine that. No, I think, though, like that, those weird experiences, you know, loss in of itself, those things all wrapped up into one probably make for some of the best, like, source material in your head when, like, kind of crafting your stories and, like, developing yourself as a writer. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. It is something that you learned a very hard lesson. I mean, there's the people out in the world who are old souls, and from my experience, those true old souls are usually people who've lost somebody when they were young,
mm-hmm.
Younger than me. And this often comes up because we've lost someone publicly, mm-hmm. and we lost someone publicly, and we didn't have as much skin in the game as others. Pedro wasn't a member of our family. Right. He's part of our chosen family. We loved him very, very much. But it isn't like losing your brother or sister or mom or dad or sibling or child or what have you. But we talked to a lot of people about loss. And it does something to you. It's formative. You learn at one point to, you know, grief is a weight that you don't ever get to put down. You just learn to carry it. You don't get over it. You just incorporate it in. And we learned that in this very weird and unique way. But we're also able to, you know, again, we loved him very, very much, but it isn't anything like the loss that Sean Sasser experienced. It isn't anything like the loss that his family experienced. That, you know, have to also contend with losing him publicly, and the plus minus of having the whole world mourn for your loved one. I mean, that's the thing, is that when you lose somebody who's close to you, you feel like the whole world should stop. And for those of us who love Pedro, that's what happened. Like, the whole world stopped and took a moment and mourned him, and still does. But there's a lot of people out there who lose people all the time, and the world doesn't stop, and the world doesn't notice. You know, and it becomes a very small place. So these were lessons we learned as very, very young people, and formed our lives and formed our work. And this is part of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of your other roommates that we haven't actually touched on. Did you have any, you know, contact in like the years that followed the real world at all, like with Rachel at all? Or what is that?
No, not really. Rachel, so obviously we didn't get along great in the house, but better than when one thought. We had very, obviously, very differing political points of view, which back then was something. It says, how to even talk about it? So, around so much of what are viewed as political point of views wind up being human rights issues now.
Yeah.
And also were human rights issues then, like debating the rights of gay people, are people living with AIDS while we were living with Pedro, was kind of a weird thing. It's like, Pedro's right here. This isn't sort of like a speculative thing if you have issues around whatever. She's gotten further along in her views and you know, conservatism has turned into an entirely different thing. And, you know, Nazis are back. You know, there's a whole lot going on. And, you know, she's a commentator on Fox News. And she did a, most of the time things would come up after the show. She spent, if Pam and I would come up, she'd often talk about how she wished she had never lived with us or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And for all the problems we have, I don't wish that. I'm glad that we knew Rachel. And as of now, we disagree on so many things, and to say disagree is an understatement. It's evolved into an entirely different kettle of fish. Right. So another reason why I'm not really sure a reunion could quite happen.
I was going to say that was another very, you know, big glaring moving part. Not only like that. Yeah. To say lightly, there would have been moving parts to get the San Francisco homecoming off the ground would have been would have been putting it lightly. I mean, like I said before, unfortunately, Pedro's no longer with us. You know, Puck's whereabouts in of itself is a story, but, you know, ensuring him to, for all intents and purposes, to be on a television show at this stage of the game in 2023 is another story. And then you've obviously got the whole Rachel element with who even knows if she would have even been keen on, you know, doing that.
Yeah.
And then Joe's obviously been away. She didn't have the most spectacular. She did a challenge and didn't have, you know, a less than ideal experience. So, you know.
No. I mean, you know, I mean, again, if we were to do it, Joe's a part of it. Joe's part of our experience. You know, yeah. She'll be there and part of that. Again, mm-hmm. like you just mentioned, all the, like, you know, different airplanes which have to land on one very, very thin runway in a way that won't crash into one another. And, you know. And I don't know if it'll ever happen. And again, I don't understand the good that would come out of it. Also, like I don't like, again, like
for you guys, probably none.
But, no. For, yeah. You know, for people watching at home, like, oh, this is gonna be a shit show. This is gonna be great. You know, that's fun. The
people living it, not so much.
No. I mean, you know, it's I think. For it to be like something that was like interesting to all of us and everyone like comes to it from a place of like, you know, respect and maturity, and we talk about things, makes for just boring goddamn TV. They're not going to want to see that. No. You know, and I'm sure if you could ever manage to get, like, you know, Puck to do this sort of thing, they're not going to pimp him to be like, to behave himself, you know, or just to be a person and like talk, which, you know, it's like, they're going to want, like, no, you gotta bring the fire, man. You gotta be you. Like, people are expecting this, or, you know, it's like, opposed to like, dude, just be cool. And we can like talk, you know, it's like, you know, you're 56 years old. So let's just, you know, like, I had to do the math in my head. Like, you know, you should just chill. All right. We're all old, you know? Yeah. I mean, for the most part, what are we going to talk about here? You know, childcare, Spanx, SAT prep. I mean, what are we going to be talking about? You know, yeah. So it's again. I think you're making a very, very good point that so much of the San Francisco folks have sort of just like, you know, you don't, you know, it's sort of gone away, and maybe that's okay. You know, maybe that is okay. Maybe it can just be what it is. You know, I mean, I say this, like, you know, I am regularly out here whoring myself, and not here. I just mean, like, you know, I sell books, man. I got a book series. I got to make sure people know about it. I'm chatting it up. I'm doing my thing. I am out there just as much as everybody else. But I'm doing that, you know. And do we talk about the real world when I do that? I absolutely talk about the real world when doing that. Is it fun for me that, you know, that I currently occupy two demographics in households now, that the moms and dads watched me and Pam and the gang on the Real World, and now I've got like 7 to 12-year-olds who just know me from my books, and that's kind of fun. And moms and dads are like, I had to tell them, like, no, I know him from television. And like, the kid's like, I don't care. You know, or the many, like, when I go on book tours, I do school visits, and I'll go on do assemblies. So I'll be there in an auditorium, like 400 kids. And at some point I might let it just might come up organically, or it could last. My mom said you were on TV. It's like, yes. Like almost 30 years ago, I was on a television show called The Real World. And I'm talking to like a third grader said, and as I say this, if you look around, there's about 7 teachers who are all throwing their heads back because they knew they recognized me from someplace and they couldn't quite put it together. And they just did. Right. And like a bunch of teams are like, yes, and come, like, yeah, it's like, yeah, you know. And then we talk afterwards, and it's a lot of like, and teachers are not old. Like, so were you 12 when you watched the show? Like, yes, I was 12 years old when I watched the show. Like, okay, now you're a 5th grade teacher. There you are. Okay, you know.
Well, in closing here, is there any because I had a subscriber actually ask me this. They wanted to know, because I think they have, like, I think it was like your first 6 books, I think they said. They wanted to know if there was anywhere, or do you, like, sign books for people by any chance?
Oh, okay. For starters, I think you're like, they were asking where they can find the books. Like, my publisher is a small independent publisher named Random House. They are only the largest publisher of books in the English language. That's an actual quote. So you can find Hilo wherever books are sold. Easy answer. As far as signed books, I could do a big old plug for my one of my local bookstores. As far as like sending them to me, don't. They're going to get lost in the mail. It happens all the time. As far as new books coming out, there's a bookstore called Folio Books in San Francisco, which is my local go-to bookstore. You can buy your books from them. I will sign them. I will personalize them. I will doodle in them to your kids or your grown-ups, and they will ship them to you, I think, for next to nothing.
Oh, wow.
Folio Books, 24th Street in San Francisco. They take care of all of my sending books to people needs. And even if it's like not just the high-low books, if it's a Pedro Me or any of my superhero books or any of those as well.
Okay. All right. So anybody that, you know, is watching or listening to this, there you go.
Boom. That's it.
Yeah. All right, Judd. Well, I had a, you know, it was an honor speaking with you today. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed this conversation. And hopefully it was as fun for you as it was for me to kind of bring you back in the Wayback Machine a little bit for this hour and change here.
Well, I appreciate it. And I appreciate it that, just like shit talking my friends at the end of my real world video, that I spent a lot of time babbling on. And I hope that was cool too. Because again, I as much as I talk about a lot of things, I don't necessarily get to talk about this as often as I used to. Mm-hmm. So it was a pleasure. And thank you, sir. You're good company. This is good hang. And you were spot on that you actually you're asking rather atypical questions, things that hit the head and the heart in the right way. So I appreciate it.
I'm an unorthodox fella. What can I say? Tongue twister there. I got to get caught up with my words. But thanks again.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too.